Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to The World Transformed 2 on Fast Forward Radio. The World Transformed 2 is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find information about this series at speculist.com and worldtransformed.com. This series explores 10 major transformations that will forever change our world and our lives. Some of these transformations are likely to be upon us soon. Others are already underway. Throughout this series, we're talking with futurists, scientists, philosophers, artists, pundits, and other thinkers to gain a better understanding of what we need to do to prepare ourselves for these changes and for life in a world transformed. In The World Transformed 2, we're exploring how we think, life extension, nanotechnology, artificial general intelligence, virtual worlds, post-scarcity, existential risks, the technological singularity, and finally, human destiny. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and I'm pleased to welcome you to part 2 in this series, Mortality Transformed. Over the ages, humanity has faced its share of adversaries: ignorance, poverty, disease, predation, to name just a few. No enemy has been more persistent than our own individual, temporal finiteness. Our mortality has been such a relentless foe that many have attempted to make their peace, claiming that the temporary and transitory nature of our existence is what makes life truly meaningful. Death is a part of life, they explain. To which some of us reply, I don't think so. Tonight we discuss whether there is an alternative to mortality as we have known it, and we have an outstanding panel with us to help explore these issues. First, I'd like to welcome Dr. Aubrey de Grey. He is a biomedical gerontologist and the chief science officer of the SENS Foundation, one of our partner organizations here at The World Transformed. He's also editor-in-chief of Rejuvenation Research, the world's highest impact peer-reviewed journal focused on intervention in aging. Aubrey's research centers on identifying the various kinds of cell damage that aging as we know it represents and developing strategies to address each. This approach is called Strategies for Engineered Negligible Senescence, or SENS. For a good overview of SENS, take a look at Aubrey's book, Ending Aging, which explains these ideas in detail. Aubrey is a fellow both of the Gerontological Society of America and the American Aging Association, and sits on the editorial and scientific advisory boards of numerous journals and organizations. Aubrey, it's always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I'd also like to introduce Maria Konovalenko. She is a molecular biophysicist and program coordinator for the Science for Life Extension Foundation. The foundation has the goal of making radical life extension a global initiative, working to integrate efforts to increase funding for research in regenerative medicine, gerontology, genetics, neuroscience, systems biology, and related sciences aimed at studying the mechanisms of aging and searching for methods to increase human longevity. Maria has written extensively about major breakthroughs related to life extension at her blog, which is linked at worldtransformed.com. Maria, welcome to The World Transformed.
Thanks very much, and it's a great pleasure for me to be here with you.
Very pleased to have you here with us. Finally, we'd like to welcome Dr. Terry Grossman. He is the founder and medical director of the Grossman Wellness Center in my hometown, Denver, Colorado, where his longevity medical practice attracts patients from around the country and the world. His special field of interest is nutritional medicine, the treatment of illness with nutrients such as vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and natural hormones, and anti-aging medicine. Terry is the author of The Baby Boomer's Guide to Living Forever, and co-author with Ray Kurzweil of Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever, and Transcend, 9 Steps to Living Well Forever. He is also the author of numerous papers published in both peer-reviewed medical journals and lay publications. Terry, it's a pleasure to have you with us this evening.
Phil, thanks so much. It's my pleasure to be here with you.
All right. Well, it's great to have a group like this together to talk about these issues. And one of the differences between The World Transformed 2 and the original series we did 2 years ago is we're taking a more personal look at these issues rather than just explaining what life extension is. We're spending some time to talk about what does it mean for people. And I think the big question about life extension, as I look at it from where I sit, the man who's going to turn 50 years of age in the next calendar year, is does it apply to me? So my first question to the panel, and I'll address this one initially to Aubrey, is are there people living today who are actually going to achieve an indefinite lifespan? And if so, what would you estimate to be the oldest member of that group?
The answer to that question does, of course, have to be very speculative, but I think that we have a 50-50 chance of developing the key technologies that will allow people to live indefinitely within about 25 or 30 years from now, and that people who are at least 60 at that time will be in a position to benefit from them. So I think that on average, the best guess is that yes, there is a high probability, I'd say at least 80%, that some people alive today will benefit from these technologies. And I would say that the best guess is that people as old as 30 or even older, maybe 40, maybe even 50, may be able to benefit. Of course, I'm talking here about people who are averagely healthy for their age. I know there are probably plenty of people listening who are biologically doing very well for their chronological age, and so would have a correspondingly greater chance for benefiting from these technologies.
So when you make that estimate, this is an interesting point that David Brin raised on the show last week. He was talking about raising the possibility that one's estimate of when it kicks in is driven by one's age. Where do you find yourself fitting in that group of people who are maybe too old to benefit? Are you somewhere on the borderline there, or right in the sweet spot, or nearing over the hill?
Well, I guess I am in the borderline, in the gray area, so to speak. But I don't know whether it's really fair to say that the estimates of how long this is going to take are dependent on one's likelihood of benefiting. I think that a lot of people have different estimates that for which that doesn't apply. In fact, I think the main problem at the moment is that, one of the biggest problems we have at the moment is that a lot of people who are in their teens or 20s or 30s feel that progress is going to be easily in time for them, and therefore they don't put very much effort into hastening that progress.
Mm. Yeah, that's a problem. Lack of, you see the same thing around retirement funding or life insurance or just eating healthy, right? The things you don't think about when you're young. And this is a particularly huge one because it's so critical for the future of not only those individuals but for all of us. Okay, same question over to you, Maria. What do you think? Are there people living today who are going to achieve an indefinite lifespan? And if so, what's the top of the age range for those who will actually live to see that?
Well, of course, there's a huge amount of people who will live, who will get there. The question about the estimate of the oldest member of that group, that's a pretty tricky one, and I totally agree with Aubrey. It's speculative right now. I would say that we are the people who work in order to make that age as big as possible. Well, it depends on our work. If there are going to be quite a lot of people and sufficient amount of people who are going to get to the point where we have all those technologies that would make us immortal, probably it's going to take a couple of decades, and the number of decades ranges from two to maybe, I don't know, five, but I personally am doing my best in order for that to be a couple of decades, as Aubrey has already mentioned. So So yeah, I think I would say that it's everybody who is going to be here for another 20 to maybe 30 years, but the amount of time that separates us and those biomedical technologies, it's a variable, and it's our goal to make it make this gap as small as possible.
Okay, well, let's keep working that gap, absolutely. But I like the range that I'm hearing, 20 to 30 years at least gives us a shot outside maybe looking at 50. 50 doesn't sound great to me. That sounds like an awful long way off to someone at my particular age. But Terry, what do you think? Same question to you.
Well, I think that realistically, you know, we're going to make incremental changes to life expectancies as we are now. We're adding, I think, in the neighborhood of 5 or 6 hours each day to human life expectancy. But in order to achieve true immortality, I think that this will probably or more likely to occur in the realm of 2045 or so, say 35 years from now. And someone like myself, who's currently 64, 35 years from now will be 99. Now, that's not an impossible stretch for me to still be alive then, because my grandfather lived to be 105, and both of my parents are close to 90, and they're still alive. So it's possible, but nonetheless, there will probably be a considerable amount of age-related damage that occurs to people my age by then, so that obviously the younger people, the people that are in their teens and 20s and 30s now, will have the best chance, I think, of achieving true immortality. And people in their 40s and 50s and 60s now, some of us may squeak under the wire, but I don't know that we'll achieve true immortality because of the amount of damage that's been done. So I think that those are realistic figures.
Okay. Well, and one of the things that this raises when you talk about it in those terms, you think about someone who is 99 when, say, the problem is substantially solved, or someone who is 75 when it's substantially solved, or any area in between there. It's not as though suddenly someone's going to flip a switch and it's cured. I think your point about it being incremental is well taken. But what you're saying is that some people will have accumulated so much, they will have aged to the point that that their lives can't be indefinitely extended, or that they can't be extended at all.
No, that's exactly right. Obviously, someone who's 99 will have taken advantage of the changes that are occurring now and will occur in the next 10, 20, 30 years.
Right.
But clearly, someone who is 15 in 2045, who's going to be born in, say, 2030, I think will be able to take full advantage of this, whereas someone who is much older, like I will be then, will be able to take some advantage, but not nearly as much.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the next question. We'll stay with you for this one, Terry, because I think this is your area of specialty. Let's talk about those of us who hope to make the cut, right? We want to make it to the stage when there really is a promise of indefinite lifespan. If you want to get there, what are the, and I always like to, you know, ask for not a huge list, but say the top three things that a person could be doing to help skew their odds in that favor. What should people be doing that they're not doing now, that they're not focusing on now, that will help them to make it to that point?
Well, I think what we're finding, above everything else, you know, the only method that's been shown so far in research studies, laboratory animals, to confer considerable increases in life expectancy is CR, caloric restriction. And what we're finding, the results of CR, the benefits, seem to be because we're lowering our levels of insulin. So if we can live a lifestyle that lowers our level of insulin, I think that's perhaps the best thing that we can do. So there are diet programs that will enable people to have relatively low levels of insulin. What I have started to do more recently and to suggest to my patients is concentrating carbohydrates, I call it the concentrated carbohydrate diet, to where we eat such way that we keep our, in other words, we avoid carbohydrates except for one meal a day, and we concentrate the carbs to that one time so that it's possible for 20 or 22 hours a day to have low carbohydrates. And I think this will be critical in terms of maybe reproducing the effects of caloric restriction, which is difficult for many of us to do 24 hours a day, day after day. So that, I think, is number one.
Before you move on from that one, Terry, just for listeners who aren't familiar, the point is that intake of carbohydrates is directly linked to insulin levels in the blood. That spikes your blood sugar, when you talk about concentrating carbohydrates or not taking them throughout the day, you're talking about managing blood sugar levels and controlling insulin through that mechanism. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. And the foods that tend to raise insulin levels tend to be starches and sugars. So desserts, pasta, potatoes, breads, grains, things along those lines are the type of foods that raise our insulin levels. And, you know, people do follow low carbohydrate diets, but most people don't seem to be able to tolerate that more than a year or two at most. It just becomes too boring. But I think this moderation of just eating the carbohydrates for one meal a day seems to be something that will translate into a doable program for life and may allow us to get the benefits of, at least some of the benefits of caloric restriction without undergoing the rigors of true caloric restriction.
Well, that's a great step in the right direction for sure, because I was going to say, you know, if low-carb diets are hard, try caloric restriction, right? That one, my take on that one has always been, I don't think it really makes your life longer. It just seems longer because you're...
Yeah, absolutely, Phil.
You're waiting for that next meal. Okay, I'm sorry, you had a couple other thoughts you wanted to share?
Well, you asked for three things, so I think that the carbohydrate concentration would be one. Our bodies were made to be exercised, yet we have a genetic code that tells us to rest whenever possible and exercise as little as possible. I think we need to overcome that genetic tendency to not want to exercise. And finally, I think it'd be a toss-up between controlling the levels of stress we have, because I think stress is a major killer when it's overdone, and most of my patients seem to be dealing with too much stress in their lives. They admit to that. And it'd either be that or looking at hormone levels and trying to maintain certain hormone levels throughout life.
Okay, so the three big bang for the buck that you mentioned were managing insulin levels, managing stress, and exercising. All right?
Yeah, exactly.
Let's pass that on to Maria. Do you have thoughts on that, other ideas that would make the list, or would you agree with Terry's list?
Yes, well, I have, I believe that the most important thing is applying personalized medicine or personalized science to yourself. Let me explain what I mean here. I think that it's highly important for a person to get all the possible medical and biochemical data about his own body. That is getting your personalized genomics test done. Ideally that would be the full genome sequence. That is it's really great that the prices are going down quite fast. So genetic tests, all the possible exams that one can get, I think this should be done quite frequently in order to monitor and do everything possible to prevent the diseases that we probably cannot see right now. On a whole organism level, but they are starting on the molecular level. So in order to minimize our disease and mortality risk, I believe it is highly important to do everything that we can right now to monitor what is actually going on in our bodies. And this can be done by any person. It's not, you know, it's not something incredible.
Maria, we're having Christine Peterson is going to be on the program next week, actually talking about nanotechnology. But we had her on Fast Forward Radio in October, I believe it was, of last year, talking about her. Promoting her personalized life extension conference, and I caught some of the live feed from there, and it seemed that much of what was being discussed was exactly what you're talking about, was people monitoring both tracking their genome and also just monitoring various biological indicators that we now have the technology and the wherewithal to track. That people just have a tremendous ability to know what's happening with their own health and to stay on top of that.
Exactly. Here you go. Exactly. That I would say this is like the first thing that we should do. And of course, caloric restriction, I'm totally on board with Terry on this one. I think this would not hurt. It's been shown that caloric restriction extends lifespan in basically every model animal. Of course, we cannot really perform experiments in people, but, won't hurt. And the third thing I would say that working with nonprofits, with people trying to fight aging, volunteer work, I think a person should be, if you want to live longer, you have to, you cannot really do it on your own. It's all about collaboration, it's about uniting, combining efforts, because our enemy is so complex and, it's aging. It's quite a number of different things, and we need a lot of scientific research to be done in order to create those technologies that
a daunting foe we're taking on in the form of aging. Absolutely. Well, in fact, we'll get to talking about what we can do as members of society, or what we should be doing to try to make society change here in a moment. So you're anticipating one of my later questions, but let's move on to Aubrey. What we've heard so far is working on our insulin levels, our stress levels, exercise, getting the data on ourselves and tracking our health at a closer level, possibly calorie restriction. How does that list sound to you, and is there anything that you would add or anything you would subtract from that?
Yeah, it's a good list. I think, I definitely want to endorse what both Terry and Maria have said. There are certainly particular parameters of health that are really rather strongly indicative of how long one's likely to stay healthy, and I would certainly say low insulin is one of them, one of the biggest ones. Other hormones, keeping them at youthful levels, as Terry mentioned, same applies. However, I also want to endorse what Maria said about the personalized nature of all of this. I think the one mistake that a lot of people make when they first start to think about taking care of their health for the purpose of postponing aging is they basically just pick up the first book that comes to hand and just do what it says. And that's not crazy, especially if it's a good book. But the ultimate number one rule has to be to pay attention to your own body, because different people need different amounts of food, or different amounts of exercise, or different balance of micronutrients in order to actually achieve the goals that Terry laid out, the maintenance of low insulin, the maintenance of youthful hormone levels, and so on. So I think Maria is absolutely right as well. The third thing I would say, no one's mentioned yet, which I think is absolutely critical, and which also does indeed presage some of your later questions, is since we are expecting that in the future, in the next few decades, as we all summarized earlier on, there will be therapies that are much more powerful in postponing aging than anything we have today, then it follows logically that one thing that we can do to maximize our chances of living a long time in a healthy state is to do whatever we can to hasten the development of those therapies, whether it be working in the right science as a biologist, or whether it be donating to it, or agitating for more money to be put into it by government, or whatever. I think, realistically, the amount that we can do to postpone our own aging with the technology that exists today, over and above the obvious things that we mentioned, is relatively modest for most people, though of course there are some people who can get a lot more. But we may very well be able to get a great deal more if we can somehow hasten the development of these therapies and thereby improve our chances of making the cut.
I think that's a good point that both you and Maria make. Whereas in structuring this discussion, I'm making a distinction between what we do for ourselves as individuals versus what we might do collectively as society. But it's a good point that if we want to extend our own lives as individuals, one of the things we should do is be making our contribution to the cause of life extension, that it's in our own interest as people who have an interest in doing this that we pursue those ends. I think that makes great sense. Well, Aubrey, I'm going to give the next question to you, but before we leave this, I just want to toss this back to Terry. Did you have any comments on the idea of the personalized, you know, biohacking approach to life extension? Is that part of what's done at your clinic?
Yeah, I have a wellness center, Grossman Wellness Center, and that's basically what we're all about. The importance is both prevention and early detection of disease. So by making the proper lifestyle choices, the goal is to prevent disease as much as possible. But in the event that something is going to happen and some disease process is going to take hold, then we would like to be able to diagnose it at the earliest possible stage when some type of curative action can be taken instead of acting after the fact. So, you know, the way that medicine is typically practiced throughout the United States and much of the world does not deal with prevention nearly to the degree that is necessary. The average face-to-face time that people spend with the physician spends with a doctor is somewhere between 5 and 8 minutes, and that's not enough to do the type of things that are necessary in order to achieve, you know, optimal health so that you can live as long as possible in the best health possible. So people, you know, luckily there's a lot of personalized medicine that's coming available online, and groups are springing up in many cities in the United States, the quantified self movement now, where people can really begin to share and track data using, you know, Web 2.0 type technologies. I think that's going to enable people to take control of this on their own, as well as with the help of their health practitioners.
Absolutely. Well, so I just wanted to swing that one back because I wanted to I had a feeling that one would be unanimous to the group, and I just wanted to double check that it was. So it sounds like it's a major part of your work as well. Okay, so let's move on to the third question, and I want to give this one to Aubrey first. I think we've talked about this in the past, Aubrey, but this is always the one that stumps me. It's the question of why is this even an issue to begin with? And what, you know, I phrase it as follows. I say, why is it that society stands ready to be organized around addressing problems like heart disease, HIV, diabetes, cancer in all its many forms, even obesity, but is like completely resistant to taking on aging qua aging, right? To talk about aging as a problem in its own right that should be addressed. Why is it an uphill battle for us to get, you know, a society, to get the people, individuals, organizations, what have you, organized around this problem? Aubrey, are you with us?
I'm sorry, yes. I think it's a multifaceted problem, really. I think that, in the first place, it's a problem of lack of understanding of what aging really is in terms of its relationship to the diseases of old age. I think that people think of aging as somehow distinct from age-related disease, as the thing that you get if you don't get any of the age-related diseases. causes and so on. Well, in fact, of course, the correct way to think about aging is that it is the lifelong process that gives rise not only to death from natural causes, but also to all of the diseases of old age. It's the only reason why those diseases are age-related in the first place. So I think that's part of the problem. And, of course, that has been progressively exacerbated over time by our terror of aging, really, by the fact that we know that it's something that we've been trying to do something about for a long time with no success at all to speak of. And so we just sort of don't want to get our hopes up and we make our peace with aging. I think the other part of it is actually that it's something that follows from that definition of aging as being the process that gives rise to age-related ill health. Because what that tells us is that treatment for aging would be, in a sense, preventative medicine for the diseases of old age.
Right.
And preventative medicine in general is actually quite a hard sell. There are a few exceptions, of course, things like statins, but in general, preventative medicine has a much higher standard of safety and efficacy that it needs to reach before it becomes widely accepted. And we can understand that. You know, I mean, it makes sense that people would make a cost-benefit estimate, and they would feel that if they're not sick yet, then they shouldn't really go near medicine that might actually make things worse, because medicine is sort of inexact science. So I think, you know, some of this is sort of rational, but most of it is very irrational.
Yeah, it seems to be. I think there may be, over the last decade or so, maybe the last 15 years, a move at least somewhat in the direction more of preventative medicine. I know that the talk of wellness is huge in anywhere where I live. In the state of Colorado, you hear about it all the time. There's a major like anti-obesity campaign going on. So it seems that as things shift related to that, as preventative medicine comes more and more into its own, perhaps that could create an opening for anti-aging research to gain some momentum.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. I basically got along with what you said.
Okay. Well, let's same question over to you, Terry. Are you accused of being, you know, a quack? Is society just not ready for anti-aging medicine? Is it? Do you see it as being the same problem today that it was a few years ago? How do you gauge this?
I think one of the biggest problems, Phil, is there is a distinction that many people don't make between the two processes of growing older and the aging process. All of us are growing older continuously because that's just the nature. We're getting older all the time. But by definition, the aging process is a harmful process. And we can look at children between the ages, say, of 5 and 15 years, and the 15-year-olds are 10 years older than the 5-year-olds, but on almost every level, they're healthier. They have higher hormone levels and they're healthier. So it is possible to get 10 years older really without experiencing much of the harmful deleterious effects that we refer to as the aging process. And I think that by aggressive application of what we know today, by incorporating, you know, all the nutrient therapies, the stress management therapies, exercise, diet therapies, detoxification strategies, relaxation therapies, and everything along those lines, and also taking an aggressive approach to ferreting out any type of cardiovascular disease or internal malignancies, the biggest killers that we have, and we do have the technology to do that in a non-invasive sense, and that's what we are doing as part of our wellness evaluations, that I think by taking advantage of this, we are able to grow older without aging even later in life, between the ages of 60 and 70, and 70, 80, and even between 80 and 90. But obviously it's much more difficult, but I think it is possible, and I think that's a distinction that's where a lot of the confusion comes, is people think that the aging process is natural. And my take is that growing older is natural, but aging is not necessary.
That's a great take. I really love that analogy of the 5-year-old and the 15-year-old. I've never thought of it in those terms before, but I have to say that that is a unconventional view, to say the very least. Do you find that you get a lot of traction sharing that idea generally, or is that something that you find yourself in arguments about? That is it pretty hotly disputed, or is it gaining some acceptance?
No, I have the opportunity to lecture often, and I will often use that example in my public lectures, and no one's ever taken exception to it. I think people can understand that. Whether or not, yeah, I think it's an attractive concept that we can grow older without aging when we're children, and it's more difficult to grow older without aging later in life, but it takes more work, but I think it is possible, and I haven't actually encountered any resistance about that idea, Phil.
Okay, great. Well, I want to give the same question to Maria, but I want to give a little bit of a spin on it this time, because when I talk about society being organized around addressing all these different problems with being resistant to anti-aging type solutions, I'm talking about North America, essentially. Maybe I might have some insight into Western Europe, but in Russia, what's the situation on the ground there? Is it similar to what we see here? Is there a good deal of skepticism around life extension research, or is it seen as more part of part and parcel of the kinds of problems that need to be solved?
I wouldn't say that the situation is really different to the situation in the West. That's because people all over the world, they don't really differ that much. And let me explain what I'm saying this. Well, I think that one of the main reasons why people are not paying any attention to the problem of aging is that because they don't think it's a problem. They are sort of like guarded, protected by their psychology from thinking about aging. And this is happening because aging leads to death. And just a simple thought about how horrible death is, that is just too much. Our psychology puts up those barriers, I would say probably at the age of 5, maybe 7 years old. When we first started, like, I think every person can remember the time when he was a kid and he thought about life and death, the universe, eternity, stuff like that. And these thoughts, they can really be terrifying. And in order not to be terrified every single moment in our lives and not to think about death all the time, our psychology puts up the barriers that prevent us from thinking about that. So that is why aging, well, death is not a problem and aging is not a problem. And the second reason, I would say that's with religion. Religion basically eliminates the problem of death at all. Religious people, they don't have this great terrifying problem of death because they're going to go in a better place, and it's just a part of their journey. This is one of the mechanisms that society has created in order not to think about death and in order to, well, function somehow.
So this is really interesting. I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's really interesting. So you find society predisposed not to address life extension, not to address aging, because we're predisposed not to think about death, because we've either gotten into the habit of ignoring the issue, or we have built up rationalizations, or we've built up alternatives through our religious belief system or other approaches that might give us some alternative to death. So with that in mind, I'm gonna give the next question to you, and that is, you know, what can we do as individuals to help shift perspectives and build some momentum around going after aging, around extending life? You're with an organization that is that is all about trying to build momentum around promoting life extension. So what can we do individually? What can I do? Okay, I'm one individual asking. What can I do to help end aging?
Well, a great number of things, actually. Well, starting with the really simple things, for example, just talking to people, spreading this idea that aging is a bad thing and it needs to be defeated, well, that can actually help quite a lot. So we need to make this problem in the society loud and clear, and if every person would think would talk to his friends, people that he knows, about how important it is to live longer and to do and to fight aging, and that is a great problem, that would help. That's number one. Well, for example, if you are a grad student or a person who works in a research institute, for instance, you can choose to work on aging-related research. You can choose your major in biogerontology. That would help. That would help a lot. If you're not involved in any kind of research activity, you can, you can first of all donate to organizations that work on fighting aging. You can volunteer. You can find all those other ways of how you can help by interacting with the organizations and finding out about the ways how you can advocate the need of increasing scientific research in the area of life extension. Well, that's the from the top of my head, the first thing.
Those are excellent ones. I think the idea that we each individually can help spread the word is a tremendous idea, and certainly the idea that those who are pursuing related fields as a career might start thinking about incorporating some of these ideas into their work is an excellent suggestion. I go back to when I first started blogging, when I first started the Spectrum.
Oh, blogging, right.
Would be another way of putting these things out. One of the first posts I ever put on the Speculist about 8 years ago, seven, 8 years ago, the title of it was "Death Sucks." Okay, that's what I call it. I said "Death Sucks," and I made this case for why we might want to extend our lives and live longer, and why we don't philosophically have to say that people dying is this wonderful natural thing. And in 8 years of blogging, I've had posts that have had more readers, but I have never written anything or said anything that got such a visceral reaction from so many people. I mean, there were quite a few who were coming in saying, "Good for you, that's right, that's true. I hadn't thought about it that way before," or "That's exactly what I was thinking." But so many people deeply disturbed that you would take that stance, and it got hit both from the religious standpoint and just from the somehow you're not a serious person, right? That you're not somehow you're not respecting death appropriately when you come out and say something like that. So I think your point that people just need to keep doing what they can to advocate this position is exactly right. It's astounding to see, astounding to me, to see how strongly people react against that idea. So, which says to me that it's an idea that we have to continue pushing that much harder. All right, Terry, how about the same question to you? What can individuals do to help change how society views this issue?
Well, the ideas that were just presented really make a tremendous amount of sense. People can, make contributions, financial, if they're not going to be directly involved in research themselves. And they can also, live their lives in a way that they can show what's possible, that it is possible to be like Jack LaLanne, who just died at 95 or 96 years of age and was still, extremely fit. And we have other people who are past 100 years of age. There was a guy named Joe Rolino, who just was hit by a car last year and at 104. And on his 100th birthday, he took a quarter, between his teeth, and then took his fingers and bent it in half with his own natural teeth and his own strength.
Wow.
Just demonstrating what's possible. So when you have a 100-year-old that's able to do that, as we get older, there's an Indian, I think it's a Navajo saying, that says people grow old and die because they see people around them growing older and dying. Mm. And I think if we can just grow older without aging and continue to have youthful vigor late in life, this will create a meme that people can connect to and will help increase the consciousness about this concept.
I got to go back to the guy with the quarter. Okay. I'm sorry, what was his name again?
His name was Joe Rolino. He lived on the East Coast.
And
he was taking a walk when he was 104, and he was accidentally hit by a car. He didn't die of natural causes.
So he might have had a couple more decades in him anyhow. What's interesting about that story about bending the quarter is the guy had great teeth too. I mean, were these right?
Yeah,
you would have to. I mean, to pull something like that.
Between the strength of his teeth and the strength of his muscles, I mean, that's really a remarkable thing to be able to do when you're that old.
Yeah, well, I couldn't remotely do that today, even if you put the quarter in a vice grip or something. There's no way. Certainly not going to risk my teeth on something like that. That's astounding. But I love the idea. I think you've introduced an important concept, the idea of creating memes, the idea of the mimetic aspect of this. And I think that's what Maria and I were talking about as well, which is just that you get the idea out there and see if, you can't push it far enough that that it gains some traction, but I think advocating through what we say is great. Advocating through how we live our lives, as you're suggesting, is perhaps more powerful even than making a good argument. So some terrific thoughts there, Aubrey. What do you think? What else can individuals do to help support this cause?
Yeah. Well, again, I want to support what's been said already. However. With regard to the whole business of advocacy and helping to change the quality and quantity of the debate on this, I think that's probably the number one thing that I always talk about when I'm asked this question, because of course it is the one thing that absolutely everybody can do. If you're not a biologist, then it's quite difficult to become a biologist and work at the bench, for example. But everyone can do advocacy. The one thing I would say is that it's not something that necessarily can be done easily. The arguments defending aging that people use may not have very much weight for you or me, but they have been developed and reinforced and ramified over millennia, and people really believe them. So the only way to really weaken someone's resolve and get them to think that at least maybe aging is actually not a good thing is to have really good arguments to the contrary and to be really able to deconstruct what's being said in defense of aging. What I always want to encourage people to do is not just to wing it, not just to do the best they can and eventually basically give up and let people change the subject. I encourage people to actually do a bunch of reading, actually learn a lot about what people like the four of us who have been thinking and talking about this for a long time have actually developed as the most effective answers to the most common complaints about the whole idea of defeating aging. I think there's a lot of literature out there, a lot of prior art, prior thought that's gone into this, and the more that one can educate oneself to know what the effective answers are, the more effective one's going to be.
I think that's a great point. And one of the things I've observed is that although there is this tremendous impulse to defend death, there's this huge impulse to defend the process of aging as natural and death as natural, the argument in favor of that position of saying, well, it's part of life, or that this is something that we by definition can't do anything about, or that shouldn't be touched, that argument does not actually rest all that easily with people who make it once you start getting into specific instances. That talking to people about their own lives, talking to them about people that they care about who are aging, or like depending on their age, you know, how that whole process is treating them, tends to help start turn the conversation around a little bit. One of the things we talked about recently on Fast Forward Radio, this has come up a few times, is that people who are opposed to extending life because one of the things I often hear, because of the population problem, that there will just be too many people. People are very good in saying in these general broad sweeping statements that, you know, people need to die so that so the population stays lower, so we don't use so many resources, so that you know, the planet stays green and we maintain our equilibrium and all those kinds of things. And it's all very well and good until you say, okay, well, I'm going to give you a lineup of people in their 70s. You pick the ones, right, that have to go, right? As soon as people start recognizing that we're not talking about something in the abstract, but that we're talking about something that impacts them personally, it impacts the people they care about, and that they know that that they don't care for those impacts, that they view those impacts as negative, we begin to make some progress. And I think you're right, Aubrey, that that familiarizing ourselves with the arguments that have really been, you know, this has been debated. I mean, I think there are good answers to most of this now, and that those who would advocate on this subject really do need to kind of sharpen it up. You know, to get back to Terry's idea of getting some memes out there. I think we need to be very crisp in getting this story out there. This is I think the right answer, and it's one that it's a story that needs to be told, that needs to be spread. Okay, well, I'm going to kind of shift gears a little bit now, and my last actual structured question before we wrap has to do with everything else, okay? Because we've been talking about some life extension techniques related to treating aging, ending aging, but that's only part of the whole taking on mortality equation. We also have ideas such as cryopreservation, the idea of suspending life right at the moment of death until technology will enable bringing a person back, or eventually farther down the road. And we'll be getting into this particular topic a little bit later on in subsequent shows on the World Transform 2. The actual uploading of human consciousness into another substrate, into the machine substrate, to enable something much closer to immortality than we can even imagine in the biological substrate. So my question to this panel is, what are your views on those kind of more far-reaching approaches? Do you see them as part and parcel of what you're doing? Do you see them as a step too far, or are they things that you think about or that you don't have too much use for? Maria, why don't we start with you on that one?
Yes, absolutely. Those both things that you mentioned, mind uploading, and I would also add cyborgization and, living in, inhabiting virtual reality. Those all are the ways of life extension. I think cryopreservation is our best option in the worst case scenario. So if we do not succeed, if we're not there, if the therapies are not there, it's a really great idea to cryopreserve your body, and therefore you will get a chance to live in the future. With minor clothing, I think the better term is the ASIM, the Advancing Substrate Independent Mind. I think that's the right scientific term because it's actually a legitimate scientific approach of tackling this idea. So there is a number of groups working on that, and the only problem is universal lack of funding. And I would really wish there were more groups, more scientific groups, working towards mind uploading. And I think that's part of my part of what I do, promotion of all those things, because we do not really know what's going to work. We cannot say for sure that that's going to be regenerative medicine or gene regulation, for example, that is going to, make us immortal. It may well be cryopreservation or mind uploading. We just don't know which approach would be more efficient. So that's why we have to pay attention to all of them.
Absolutely, that makes sense. I like the phrase the term substrate independent mind. I think that is a real refinement over the idea of mind uploading. And that reminds me that I need to familiarize myself maybe with some of the more current thinking on this, because that's a really interesting way of putting that. What do you think, Terry? This kind of stuff too far out, or is it part of what do you see that as an extension of, or as part of what you're involved in?
No, I don't think it's at all far out. I, in fact, at one time worked as a medical advisor for Alcor, who's involved with cryosuspension, and participated in cryosuspension myself as a physician. So I don't think that's far out at all, and I think it's a realistic option for people. What they're doing now is vitrifying the head of people, and obviously it's a little bit gruesome to think about getting decapitated, but the reality is that in order to avoid the freeze damage, you need to do a process called vitrification, where instead of freezing, it turns into a glass-like substance, and to do that, the cooling has to occur very, very rapidly, and with current technology, we can't vitrify the entire body yet, but hopefully we'll be able to soon. But right now they're doing this process, and conceivably this will enable memories to remain intact such that when the thawing occurs in the future, they will be able to download those memories because they will have figured out ways to reverse engineer the brain. So I think it's a good measure for people that are too old now to take full advantage of what's going to occur in the time of the singularity later this century. In terms of if we're talking about true immortality, I think one way or the other we're going to have to leave our bodies, because the body will, wear out eventually, and the ability to make backup copies of our consciousness and memories or just live entirely virtually will be the best prospect for true immortality, and I think that's also another realistic concept.
Interesting point about vitrification of just the head. For our listeners' benefit, let's talk about that just a little bit further, if we could. The idea that you can keep the head versus the entire body. Now, you said eventually they might be able to keep the whole body, but if the point is just to copy those memories out of the brain, what would the point of preserving the whole body be anyway? Or is there any thought to actually reanimating the body that has been preserved?
Well, there may be, and there also may be, memories stored in other places in the body and there are acupuncture meridians and things like that, and energetic fields throughout the body. And there may be things that we don't know yet that we may be losing by just saving the head, which is the best we can do right now with vitrification. So the answer is we don't have the technology to know for sure, so it might make more sense to just save the entire body.
Okay, all right. But the kind of working plan, the assumption is that what we're doing is we're using our own brains, we're using our own remains, if you will, as a backup. That this is kind of storing the backup so that eventually that backup can be read into some other into some other interface, and that the person can be restored elsewhere, either in a new body or more likely that consciousness would be moved into a computer substrate.
Yes, exactly right. Because you know, we could take a cell now, and within every cell, within the nucleus of that cell, is the DNA that we could create eventually an entirely new being that would be identical in some sense to what we are now, but without the conscious and memories, it wouldn't make any sense to do that. That's why we need to also preserve the brain.
Right. Okay. So, Aubrey, same question. Actually, I want to ask you whether you're okay with these things, because I'm pretty sure you are. Anything to add on either cryonic suspension or mind uploading?
Yeah, not much, really. I mean, I certainly share with the other panelists the view that this is very much all part and parcel of what we do, what we're interested in developing with the goal of saving lives and alleviating suffering and generally having people not get sick and die. I think the point that we don't really know which ones are going to happen first and which ones are not is very important. I think that's one of the big reasons for everyone who works in this area, whichever part of it they work in, to be strongly supportive of the other areas that other people are working in. And, of course, there's also the fact that even for any particular order in which these technologies arrive, they will have more effect jointly than they would have individually. Terry, together with his co-author Ray Kurzweil, put this, I think, extremely well a few years ago when they talked about the concept of a bridge to a bridge to a bridge of successively more powerful and but yet more sophisticated and difficult technologies being able to help people to, as they said it, live long enough to live forever. And I think this very much applies to the sorts of technologies that we're talking about now as well, that we will end up progressively broadening our arsenal of medical interventions, and in doing so, we will progressively push back the ill health of old age further and further, ideally, of course, faster than time is passing, so that we maintain what I've called longevity escape velocity. I think that really, if one takes the logical view that the postponement of old age is always going to be a good thing, however long ago you happen to have been born, then it sort of goes without saying that one has to be supportive of all of these technologies, not just the biotechnological ones or the more traditional ones.
Well, the great thing about having a kind of a broad array of options, a broad array of possible technologies, possible solutions that address this in different ways, is that you've got the possibility of filling in the gaps where one solution isn't going to get you there. You know, we started out talking about who are the oldest people who are going to make it to indefinite lifespan. Well, the thing is, if you don't count yourself in that group, if you look and say there's just no way I'm going to make it, well, suddenly, you know, you do have an option if you look at, for example, cryonics. It's a question of whether you're willing to embrace a different approach rather than the one that you started out looking at. And I think the same will be true as people look at ultimately limitations to living in the biological substrate or limitations to this indefinite life that we view from this side of where we are in time as something that would be wonderful and perfect. Well, it'll be fraught with problems too. That ultimately the whole biological substrate will be seen as problematic, and people will want something more. And ultimately, maybe uploading into that next substrate will provide the next step forward. So the idea that that we provide a means of working from one step to the next by looking at this entire range of solutions, it seems to me makes an awful lot of sense. Well, I'm going to have to start to wrap it up here, but I hate to end this when we're covering such great topics. So what I'd like to do is just give everyone the opportunity to share anything that I didn't make an opportunity to talk about by asking a specific question about. Just any parting thoughts or other ideas that you would care to talk about related to life extension. And Terry, if it's okay, we'll start with you on that.
Oh, thanks, Phil. We haven't talked about, you know, some of the things that I think are going to be very exciting in the next 10 and 20 years, and that's both stem cells and nanotechnology. We just didn't have time to get to those, but I think these are some of the bridges that are going to take us into the future. And stem cell therapies are coming online today. We're doing stem cell therapies to some degree, to a limited degree, with orthopedic and cosmetic applications. Even in my clinic today, outside of the United States, they're using them to treat lung problems, cardiovascular problems, diseases that we're not able to treat very well otherwise, and we're doing research on those in the United States. And honestly, I think that the stem cells, in some sense, we can regard them as biological nanobots that travel through the body, repairing damage. And we can use these over the next 10, 15 years, 20 years, until the engineers are able to create the mechanical nanobots that will repair the damage. So there's some really exciting things coming in the future, and this idea of living long enough to live forever, I think, really does make sense. So we should try to take the best care of ourselves that we can, so that we can take as much advantage of what's coming ahead in the next few decades.
Absolutely. Great thoughts there, Terry. Thank you for those. All right. Maria, what about you? Some things that you would like to have talked about that we didn't give you an opportunity to, or any other parting thoughts you'd like to share with us?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do have one thought. I think it would be really great. It would speed up things tremendously if life extension, actually life and life expectancy were the main criterion of the effectiveness of governmental agencies. I think this can change quite a lot. If you imagine if lifespan, the average lifespan of a country, if that would be the measure of how effective the police works or how effective the highway patrol works, that would help out the situation a lot, because obviously not only these agencies that I mentioned would be involved, but the whole system would be changed, and quite a lot of money would eventually go into scientific research and into transformation of the social issues, social problems that we're dealing with right now. And I mean, every country has quite a lot of social problems. Either it's Russia or it's the States. And if the criterion would be the lifespan, that I think that would accelerate things quite a bit.
Okay, great thoughts there as well. Aubrey, how about yourself? Anything to add?
Well, I guess, of course, the biggest area that we haven't spent much time on today is the actual nuts and bolts of the whole thing. As was just mentioned, we haven't talked about the actual ways in which medicine is in striking distance of becoming able to combat aging comprehensively. And I guess the reason I mention that is because if we come back to the previous question you asked about what can people do, and my emphasis on advocacy and giving good answers, one of the best things that one has to do, one of the most important things, is to make sure that people can't just say, well, it's never going to happen, therefore it doesn't really matter whether I have a serious conversation about whether it would be a good thing if it did happen. I think it's absolutely imperative in any discussion with people who are opposed to all of this work to be able to hold one's own on the science as well, and to actually be able to, essentially force the people one's talking to address the feasibility question and the desirability question separately. It's just not good enough to let people essentially not think about these things in an adult, mature way because they don't think that they're relevant to the real world.
Absolutely. These are serious issues. We really have to start taking them seriously and not letting people just kind of, you know, wiggle out of the discussion, because it's too important of a discussion to be having. Well, I could go on talking with the three of you all night, but we're very near on the time that we have remaining, and I just want to say thank you to Aubrey de Grey, to Terry Grossman, and to Maria Konovalenko. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for sharing your perspectives on these issues, talking with us about Mortality Transformed. That's going to do it for this edition of The World Transformed 2. I'd like to thank our guests once again for guiding us through our thinking on these issues, and I want to thank all of you for listening, for joining us, and a special shout out to everyone in the Fast Forward Radio chat room. Thanks for being with us tonight. I'd also like to say a big thank you to our partner organizations for helping to make this show possible. Those groups are the SENS Foundation, the Foresight Institute, Humanity Plus, and Singularity University. We have information about all four of those organizations at worldtransform.com, and we will be talking about each of them in a little bit more depth in our final four shows in this series. Next week, The World Transformed 2 continues with Part 3, The Material World Transformed. Join us as we welcome Christine Peterson and Jay Storrs Hall to discuss the amazing transformative potential of nanotechnology. We hope that you'll be able to be with us next week, and we hope you'll be able to join us for all of The World Transformed 2. Until next time, live to see it. Friends, this is Phil and Steven coming at you live for a quick wrap-up discussion after that program. It occurred to us that we had pre-recorded the show with some time constraints, and that it would be a good idea to come in and add a few comments. Steven, you were awfully quiet during this program. Didn't hear much out of you.
I had a great vacation with my family last week, and while I was able to participate in the first show of The World's Transformed 2, I was unfortunately not able to participate in this one until now, and so I'm glad for the opportunity to get to weigh in even a little bit here.
Let me give you that opportunity, since I got to talk for with each of them, and I got to blather on about my thoughts. What are your takeaways from what you just heard?
Well, obviously these guys, great panel. I don't know that I could have we could assemble a better panel than these folks. I thought something that Sally said just now in the chat room is worthy of kind of bringing into this discussion a little bit, because it's actually something that's come up with Aubrey in a previous show, and I think it's worth mentioning. She says in the chat room, every bit of research devoted to curing certain diseases is also anti-aging research by definition. I think I said something very similar to Aubrey in a previous show, and he took issue with that. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that. No, that's interesting. What do you think? Where do you suppose the difference lies between you and between that position as Sally has stated it and you've bought into it and where Aubrey stands?
Well, I think Aubrey was quick to say, you know, you're right in some of the small, you know, in some of the small ways that you know we'll learn this, we'll learn that, just normal medicine will bring us answers to this small problem and that small problem. But he is of the mindset that a holistic approach is the only way we can get this massive problem set taken care of within any kind of reasonable time frame. It's one thing to say, let's say in 1962 or whenever it was, that you know, one day we can solve all these problems and you know men will be on the moon, and a wholly different thing to say, you know, and we're going to be there in 10 years, and to lay the gauntlet down the way Kennedy did, and because you know there's no, you know had that not happened, is there anybody that would think that we would have made it to the moon by 69 had that not been put down the way it was. So,
right.
You know, I think that's Aubrey's point of view is that, you know, sure, it's great that, you know, just by happenstance, we've come across an answer to this problem or that problem. But unless we get serious about outlining what the problems are and then solving them with the goal of curing aging in mind, you know, it might be hundreds of years before we get there. And whereas if we lay down the gauntlet and say we're going to do it and let's solve these problems, then we can get there much faster. And so he took a little issue with that. And you know, I think there's some wisdom to that.
Well, he thinks about it a lot. Let's give him credit.
Yeah, he does.
But I think there's also a subtle distinction between life extension and anti-aging, and I think that any of those three would agree that curing any disease, dealing with anything that kills us, contributes to life extension because we live longer. But it doesn't do anything to aging per se, right? That's maybe the difference, that when we cure a disease, we aren't actually taking a notch out of aging. We are extending life, but as Aubrey makes the point in the interview we just concluded, these diseases of aging are enabled by aging. So I think maybe there's a cart before the horse kind of thing when you say that if you cure the diseases, then you're curing aging. It's I think his point would be no, it would just they would enable other diseases that would take you down. And I do remember when we talked about the seven strategies for engineered negligible senescence, that definitely that's an all or nothing deal, right? If you don't have all seven of those, you don't cure aging. If you get six out
That's
of seven,
right.
You're not that much better off than having one out of seven or none out of seven, unfortunately.
It's like, the analogy was this. We have seven bullets flying at us. And
right.
You can deflect one of those bullets.
Dodge four of them, yeah.
Yeah, and, yeah, exactly. You're just as dead. You know, I mean,
right.
And the reason that is because these seven things, these seven diseasing, aging processes that kill you, are all fatal, and they all show up within a normal lifespan. And so, you know, if you don't handle all seven of them, then that's then you know you may have some small benefit from handling one or two, but you're going to be just as dead from the both that remain, and that's a little bit. I have to admit, when he said that in that show that we had him on about a year or so ago, I found that to be just a little bit discouraging. But he doesn't allow that to discourage him. He's outlined these seven things and has a whole book on how we handle each of these seven problems. And in his view, these are all realistic he has a realistic time scale, he believes, to problem solve. So,
I thought it was interesting, and I did bring it up, that last week David Brin made that comment about the older you are, the quicker you think life extension is going to show up, or the quicker that you think the singularity is going to occur. And I know we had this discussion going in the chat during the interview about even singularity-aware futurists who are very skeptical about life extension. Michael Anisimov's name came up, and I mentioned, I believe, John Smart is, if not life extension, anti-aging. I guess we should curing aging. That's the thing that some transhumanists think we can do, and some think that is too tough of a nut to crack. Terry Grossman, actually touched on one of the things that was mentioned in the chat room and that we didn't spend a lot of time on this program talking about, but nanotechnology promises to, I think, really be a game changer where anti-aging is, where medicine is concerned anyway, because it levels the playing field between technology and biology. It allows us to work with biological material on its terms, at its scale. And the idea that some things are too complicated or too hard or completely intractable, they are when everything, when all of your tools are at this huge macro scale. But when you're actually able to make these kinds of changes at the molecular level, to say that to say what's not possible in terms of any kind of medicine or even curing, reversing aging, or any number of other remarkable things that I think are implied by nanotechnology, you really miss the point. And I thought that he made an excellent point about the fact that stem cells are kind of a, if not a first example of nanobots, they're kind of a proof of concept of nanobots, and that already some of the kinds of treatments that will be available in the near future via nanotechnology is getting kind of, we're getting a foretaste of that with stem cells.
You know, I think that computer systems, AIs, accelerating tech associated with Moore's law and all that, is that's going to be a huge part of this picture too. How cool would it be, Phil? You have a, let's say you have a down to the molecular level simulation of the human body, and then you apply, maybe some form of Watson that's gone to medical school, or maybe even some sort of evolutionary algorithm to evolve solutions to aging. You know, I mean, it might be that some of these problems are solved by machine rather than our own intelligence. So, it's going to be interesting to see how fast these solutions come. And I'm with you. The sooner the better. If not even just for myself, I'm kind of attached to a lot of people that are my age and older. I have some good friends in the age categories that I would love to see saved along the way, and so and frankly, I don't have a soul. There's not a soul out there that I would wish senescence upon. So the faster the better.
I could not agree more. And I'll tell you, when I watch these photos of the people we had on the program, and I see I left Greg Benford's photo up there, so sorry for misleading everyone that he was going to be on. He had been originally scheduled to be on, and we will be talking to Gregory Benford in the fall. Of course, he's with Genescient, which he's on the board of directors of that, I believe chairman of the board of that company, which is a supplement for anti-aging. So it'll be really interesting to get his perspective as well. But anyway, I was going to say, when you look at Terry Grossman, okay, and you say, this man is 64 years old, this is the doctor I want to help me with aging, okay? I mean, does he look like he's 64 to you? He certainly doesn't to me. I was really surprised when he gave his age. I mean, I was truly surprised. I was like, I would not have guessed. I was thinking my age, right? Maybe a couple years on top of me, but...
Yeah, 50 at the most, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So, you know, that's the anti-aging doctor you want, right? The one you look at him and you immediately think he's 15 years younger than he actually is. I think that's an excellent sign.
Exactly. He's got some knowledge. He's figured some things out. But it's I think that there's a lot to the low carb dieting. I think that resistance training helps, and those are the things that do me the most good when I'm actually doing them. You know, I mean, that's the thing. some of the things that we can do to help ourselves. You just have to.
We don't avail ourselves.
As much as we should. That's right.
I think there's an important distinction between the wellness preventative side, the low carb diet to prevent obesity, which actually has tremendous life extension properties in its own right. Right. If you're not obese, you reduce your risk of heart disease, you reduce your risk of cancer, you reduce your risk of diabetes. All these prime indicators of an earlier death go away. So if you don't have obesity, and then strength training, the more muscle you have on your body, the more resistant you are to a lot of those kinds of things. But I think over and above that, somehow just controlling those insulin levels mitigates some damage to the body. I believe that's where he was going with that. So you've got this, it's life extension and it's anti-aging. If you avail yourself of the low carb, or what did he call it, condensed carb diet, where you just eat carbs once a week? Because I know that's similar to
actually he was doing it once a day. He said
once a day. Yeah,
it,
I was going to say that you were talking about one where people do it once a week, right?
Right. That was I've found that's actually quite doable. It was the 4-hour body guy who advocates once a week that on Saturday. You just anything that you've been craving, anything you desire, just chow down all you like on Saturday, and then be very, very, be very careful as to what you eat. Try not to eat a carb throughout the rest of the week. And the guy's in awesome shape, and he monitors his insulin level with a real time computer. Even though he's not a diabetic, he's a hardcore guy, and. He finds that doesn't, hitting insulin like that once a week does not cause a problem with weight gain and other issues like that. So, so he's condensing it all to one day, whereas Dr. Grossman's saying, one meal a day, every day. So, whatever.
Either way, it comes down to drastically cutting the amount of sugar in your diet to get those insulin levels under control and to optimize your health. So, that was interesting stuff. I really enjoyed hearing them interact. Last time we had Aubrey and Terry on, they were on. We recorded separate interviews with them, so it was great to hear the three of them interacting with each other. They obviously have all encountered each other before and know each other's work, and I found that. Just that part of it very encouraging, that you've got this tremendous team of people working on this problem. Hopefully they're gonna come through for us here in the next few years.
Absolutely. Well, what's next week, Phil?
Next week we've got the Material World Transformed. We'll be talking with Jay Storrs Hall and Christine Peterson about nanotechnology. It's going to be very exciting. Looking forward to that. We may have one other panelist. I'm still working on somebody, so I'll be sure and get that up there as soon as we know for sure.
Absolutely. Well, looking forward to next week, and that'll be a live show. We'll be live next week.
We will be back on live. Looking forward to that. Well, Sally says we're down to our last minute. We better go ahead and hit the theme music and call it a night. So until next time, live to see it. If you can find that theme music there.
Okay.
Oh, I meant to say, right, Jean-Sébastien Bemius is the composer of our music. Thanks for the music, Jean-Sébastien. We appreciate it.
And Stephen is still looking. Well, anyway, good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. You heard it before. It's a good tune.